This is Lou Hansen, senior editor and co-founder of the Virginia Center for Investigative Journalism at WHRO. In a time of political turmoil, it's easy to overlook the people who work to exercise and support our core American values. Democracy at Work is an election season series from PCIJ at WHRO. People share their stories about how they uphold the core ideals of American democracy: free and fair elections, the defense of the country, ensuring clean air and water, the right to participate in government deliberations, and exercise First Amendment rights. This weekly series brings these compelling stories to light. Melody Barnes has spent much of her career dedicated to public service. The Richmond native earned her law degree from the University of Michigan, but instead of pursuing a career in corporate law, she chose public policy. Among her many roles, Barnes served as chief counsel to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. She was an assistant to President Obama and director of the White House Domestic Policy Council. Barnes is now the executive director of the Karsh Institute for Democracy at the University of Virginia. For this story in our Democracy at Work series, I talked to Barnes about her family history and what drew her to public service. Why don't we just start, and you can tell me about the men in your family and their military service. What do you remember your father telling you about working for the military?
It's interesting when I think about that. In some ways, it just was. I mean, it was a part of who he was. My dad passed last August. So it was a part of who he was and what he did all of his life. I mean, he was enlisted in the Army before I was born, before he married my mom, but was working at what was then called Fort Lee in Petersburg, Virginia, his entire career. And in the conversations we had at home, it was the conversation that you would hear two adults having, my parents having, about their work. I remember the more intense periods, for example, during the first Gulf War, and my father was just working constantly. And I would think about what he was doing. I was much older then. I was a young adult by that point. I was thinking about the importance of what he was doing in the context of what was happening domestically and globally. Mm-hmm. And the way that he carried out that function through his work for the Department of the Army. Mm-hmm. There were also a lot of stories that he would tell about the arc of his service. He would talk about the time that he was stationed in Japan at the end of the Korean War. And so we would talk about that. Or from time to time, he would talk about a relationship with the people that he worked with or a general that wanted or needed something because of the work he did. But it was more that it was just part of the air that I was breathing. It was part of who my father was.
Were there lessons about service in that?
There was definitely a clarity about the importance of service. And I would say that I drew upon that. I recognized that not only because of what my father did, but because of who he was. And it's not just my dad, it was my mother and my father. My mother was an educator, a public school educator. And so she was a teacher for many years, and then she was a curriculum specialist. And like my father, again, it was a part of who she was. I think for both of them, growing up as African Americans in Virginia and thinking about the opportunities that were available to them, my mother and I would sometimes talk about why she became a teacher and what if she had been born 20 years later, 30 years later? And we always arrived at the conclusion that she would have done the exact same thing because of her love for education and for public education and her deep commitment to that. And for both of my parents, in addition to the work that they were doing, there was also just the way that they lived their lives. It was the way that they walked through life, and that was being of service to the community. I was born in the mid-60s, and there were not often opportunities for pools, for example, swimming pool, that I could go to. And my dad, with others in the community, formed an association that was integrated to build a pool that Black and white families would enjoy. And my parents were very active there. My father was the vice president of the PTA. My mother was a president of the Band Boosters Club. My father's name was Charles H. Barnes, Jr., and he worked, as I said, then what was known as Fort Lee.
There were more opportunities for an African-American woman of your generation than there were for your parents' generation. You had your own accomplishments, academic. You went to law school at Michigan. I imagine you have many friends from your graduating class that went into, that have their names on buildings and have private firms that are named after them. You chose a different path. What attracted you to public service?
Well, when I first finished law school, I went to a big firm in New York. And I found the subject matter really intellectually interesting. And I learned a lot at the firm. I was there for almost 3 years, but I realized that it was not my passion. And I started to reflect on what it was that I cared deeply about. What it was that I, when I picked up the paper or picked up a book, what was I reading about? What got my blood flowing? And I returned to the issues that I cared about since I was a little girl, about government, about service, and the way in which the law could create opportunity and be of service to the public. And that led me to have conversations with people about opportunities that may arise in Washington, D.C. And I got very, very fortunate when I was having a conversation with person who was an adjunct law professor. He went on to lead the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Same with Ted Shaw. And he said, you know, you should call a friend of mine. She works on the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil and Constitutional Rights. And a couple of months later, I was moving to Washington to serve as an assistant counsel on that subcommittee.
Wow.
And it was, you know, a moment in which luck and preparation came together, and I began my career in Washington, D.C., and working in government.
Yeah. And you also worked with Senator Kennedy. Describe that role, and what do you think is your signature success from that time with him?
So I started working for Senator Kennedy in 1995. I started out as his general counsel, and a couple of years later became his chief counsel on the committee. And the swath of issues that one covers when one works on the Judiciary Committee includes everything from immigration to criminal justice issues to antitrust to judicial confirmations and the confirmation process to issues of reproductive health. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And they are some of the most hot button issues.
Scrutinized issues.
Right.
In the country.
That's
for
right.
Decades now.
Right. That the country wrestles with and has for as far back as I can remember, and I would imagine will do so for generations to come. And I also supervised his Judiciary Committee staff. And it was just one of a job of a lifetime, not only to work on that set of issues, which are deeply meaningful to me, but to work for someone who was so central to the debates of that time. So I worked on everything from, you know, analyzing then Microsoft's antitrust litigation and the hearings that we did on those issues to big judicial confirmation hearings. And I think as the country can see now, no matter where you sit on the ideological spectrum, those who sit on our federal courts shape the life of our country and obviously the interpretation of the Constitution. So I worked on those issues and was really proud to do that working for Senator Kennedy. I worked on a number of big issues. Some of them I started working on with him, for example, passing hate crimes legislation. And I started working on those issues with him, and they were signed into law when I was President Obama's domestic policy advisor. Worked on issues trying to ensure that those who are gay, lesbian, and gay and lesbian, at that time the bill focused on those who are gay and lesbian, to ensure employment, their employment rights. That's legislation that still has not been passed. So these are big generational issues and issues that go to the heart of who we are as a country, and people wrestle with them.
You are in these negotiations about some of the most divisive issues in America today, and you're with the people who are making these decisions. So you're in the room with the decision makers, senators, President Obama, on these divisive issues. What was your takeaway when dealing with people who are on the other side of the issue? How were those negotiations? How were, did you see a change in the time there?
One of the things that I experienced when I was a staff person on the Hill, and this is working and in the White House, so working for the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate and in the White House, but particularly when I worked in Congress, that over and over and over again, I found people who wanted to get things done. And yes, there were those who were considered to be obstructionist. But over and over and over again, people were fighting the good fight for the things that they believed in, but also had a sense of what the North Star was, which was to get things done for their constituents. And that certainly was what guided Senator Kennedy. And as strongly as he held his opinions and as robustly as he could argue for them, he was a person who believed that there were times when you had to hold the line, but when you wanted to get something done, you had to negotiate. And he would say to me, you know, Melody, in the United States Senate, one person can stop anything because of the rules of the Senate. So you have to build a coalition. You have to build consensus. And what I learned watching him and working with him and the expectation was that you built relationships and you negotiated with those on the other side of the aisle. And often we had really wonderful relationships. There are people that I have called on since working with them on the Hill, and they worked for Republicans, I worked for a Democrat, who would say, sure, absolutely, I will help you with that. Mm. And I think that goes to the heart of public service, that we represent our constituents. We have, in our cases then, our bosses had strongly held opinions, and you would try to get as much as you could based on those beliefs. But you also recognize that for government to work, for our democratic institutions to work, compromise was required. It wasn't a dirty word, and it was necessary.
You saw that in your career. You became a domestic policy lead under President Obama.
Yes.
Some of the things that you worked under Senator Kennedy were actually passed under President Obama.
President Obama signed the hate crimes bill into law. I worked on that from 1997, and he signed it into law, I think, in 2009, 2010. Sometimes it takes a long time. Also, you know, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was the policy with regard to civil rights in the military. And so one of the things that I learned was that public service does take patience. The wheels sometimes turn very, very slowly. The system was designed to move slowly. But over that period of time, we also saw support and public sentiment shift.
You were part of the transition team for President Obama. You worked with outgoing President George W. Bush. Tell me about some of those negotiations. As you said, it was in the middle of the Great Recession. It's shortly after a hard and bitterly fought election between Democrats and Republicans for the presidency. What was it like coming into the room? And what was the feeling, working with them for weeks?
That moment in time so strongly spoke to me about what makes our democracy unique and important and what has sustained it for hundreds of years, which is the idea that we have elections, people cast their vote, that vote matters, and those who are in power act accordingly. And as a result, and do it with a level of respect for the rule of law. And as a result, what I encountered when I started meeting with the George W. Bush's domestic policy advisor and George W. Bush's staff was one that it had been made very, very clear, starting with the president and the chief of staff, that they were to throw open the doors, welcome us in, and work with us to make sure that that transition of power was as smooth as it possibly could be. And to me, that is one of the clearest examples of public service. It is the setting aside of what you might want personally, that they all probably voted for Senator McCain to become the next president, but Senator Obama was then president-elect. And as a result, it wasn't just, come in and that's where the office is and, there are the file cabinets.
Sure.
A lot of time was spent walking through with us the way that they had set things up, why they had done things a particular way, how they had organized the policy development process. And all of that was happening at the same time that members of our transition team and those that had been tapped by then-President-elect Obama to hold positions in his administration were also working together on legislation, working together on policy development, because the nation was in a spiral, an economic spiral, and there were joint efforts, the linking of arms to make sure that we could stop the spiral and to stabilize our economy. That is, that is country over party. That is respect for the rule of law. That is respect for democratic institutions and respect for the will of its citizens.
Karsh Institute now is examining the threats to democracy today. A lot of times we have a feeling that there is party over country in a lot of these issues. Tell us what Karsh is doing right now.
Well, if I had to summarize our work, I would say that we are promoting good governance and meaningful engagement in civic life. Sitting underneath that is a recognition that there are core elements of our democracy, the strength of our democratic culture, the robustness of our democratic institutions, the access to reliable information so that those living in the country can make wise decisions about all of the above. And there are also significant trends that are making that a challenge and that are creating opportunities. When we think about the rapid transformation of technology that is affecting our culture, the way we get information, the way that we see one another, the way that we engage with one another, There are economic and social barriers that make it more challenging for people to participate in our democracy. And there's a weakening of our civic health, our ability to agree in a way that allows us to move forward or to productively disagree so that we are living in a country that isn't buffeted by political violence or the threat of political violence and certainly polarization. And so we think about the way those trends affect those core elements, those foundational elements of democracy, mm-hmm. and that is where we focus our attention. So we examples of that would be our work on local journalism to try and create a stronger media ecosystem so that people are able to get information that's reliable and that allows them to make the best and smartest decisions in their opinion mm-hmm. about the way their communities and their country and the world should move forward. You know, the work that we do, you know, working with students, but also supporting elected and appointed officials in what we consider to be some of the competencies of democracy. We just recently launched our Student Dialogue Fellowship, and literally hundreds of students at the University of Virginia from different backgrounds, different places on the ideological spectrum, from different parties, from 11 of the 12 schools at the university, so they all want to do different kinds of things, raise their hand to say, I am eager to spend time in a place with people who are different than I am to talk about the election of 2024. And in doing that, part of what we are doing for them, and this goes to the question about the competencies of democracy.
You get to work with lots of students and young professionals, and I'm sure you have mentored many and spoken to many, many more. What do you tell them about a career in public service and a mission-driven career?
I tell them that it is one of the highest callings, and it is deeply, deeply fulfilling. And when I read about the individuals that you all are featuring in your work, I think how honorable those individuals are. I think that they are the fuel that helps their communities move forward, helps the country move forward.
Right.
And I not only think about that through the lens of the work that I'm doing now and in retrospect, I remember when I was working in Washington and, you know, the Capitol and the Senate and House office buildings, that was my workplace. But there were times when, you know, I'd walk out of the Capitol in the evening and, you know, the sun was setting and I would just pause to stop and reflect on where I was. Hmm. And there were days and I would walk through the Capitol and I would think about the other people over generations whose feet had touched those steps, who had made decisions and who had fought battles and engaged in debate in that place. And it never got old.
So there's a real faith in democracy that you've seen in your career.
Yes, there is. And I'm not naive. I'm not Pollyanna. I see and I am deeply concerned about what I see today. But I also know that something else exists, that if we help ensure that people believe and feel that democratic institutions are responding to them, that they are heard, that they can be active participants, yes, on election day, but on the days in between, that we can certainly reinvigorate that feeling among more people.
Democracy at Work is a project of the Virginia Center for Investigative Journalism at WHRO. The series has been edited and produced by Lou Hansen, Christopher Tyree, and Michelle Hankerson. The American Press Institute and Virginia Humanities provided financial support. Additional thanks to the Karsh Institute for Democracy at the University of Virginia and to the Libraries of Virginia.